In Psalm 8, David says this, "When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him and the son of man that you care for him?" David's reaction of looking at the heavens is one of worship and one of feeling insignificant by virtue of God's creation. Well, if that was true in David's day, about 1000 BC, it became more and more true as time went on and people really understood what the heavens were actually like. And we're going to cover the first part of that this week, hopefully, and leave it to Jay to pick it up next week. Oh, I got some preliminary ones. That's a photo of the moon that I took last night on my driveway with a point-and-shoot camera. I love the moon. It's awesome for taking pictures. It looks so fantastic. The lights are awful bright, but that's okay. That's an eclipse, as a lot of you probably saw, and some of you probably went and actually saw the totality of it. That was what we saw in Irvine last year. And this was a really cool thing. We did this in 2012. We took this picture. This is a transit of Venus. This is the planet Venus crossing in front of the sun. The next time, if you want to catch it, next time it'll happen December 21, 17. So we wanted to be sure to catch it when we had the chance. Okay, this is a familiar scripture that's our theme, but I want to use it for one other thing here. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There's no speech, nor are there words, whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. To me, what he's saying here is there's no language, there's no culture on earth that doesn't understand this. It's language independent. It's universal testimony. But later in the psalm, he changes gears and he says this, and starting in verse 7, "The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart." And so on. So he's shifted from the general revelation of who God is and his nature in the created world, in the created universe, to a special revelation that comes from the Word of God and the law of God. That's a step above, a step of clarity, a step of reality and revelation that isn't available in just nature alone. And finally, David, at the end of the psalm, he's saying, "In prayer, let the words of my mouth and meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer." So he's gone all the way from general revelation to special revelation in the Word of God to personal encounter with the Lord and prayer and asking that God would actually reveal to him, you know, that his heart might be acceptable in his sight. Okay, this is Genesis 1, 14 and 15. God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth." And so it was. And I'm not talking about, you know, timing of creation or any of that, but just God's purpose in the heavens with respect to man is that they would be for times and seasons for light upon the earth. Not for special revelation or for personal relationship or worship. Another familiar scripture that Pete went over last week, "What can be known about God is plain to them," that is to all men, all human beings, "because God has shown it to them, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made." And then it goes on down in verse 25, "For although they knew God, but did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but instead worshiped and served the creature, the creation, rather than the creator who is blessed forever." And this kind of helps us understand some of the things in the history of astronomy that we're talking about, especially the very early history of it, which we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on, but nevertheless, that's a good background to have in the scripture. Deuteronomy 4, one last passage. "Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully. Since you saw no form on the day that the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, beware lest you act corruptly by making a carved image for yourselves. And beware lest you raise your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, you be drawn away and bow down to them and serve them. Things that the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven, as we saw in Genesis 1. It's allotted to all the people, but it's not given to the people as a God to worship or as one to seek direction of life from. Okay, let's look at the outline then. And then we'll check out some more stuff. The physical heavens both reveal God's existence as God. We got that from Romans 1. And serve as a calendar to mark regular seasons. You see that from those other scriptures. Ancient astronomers observe the sun. The solstice is when the seasons are at the extremes. The winter and summer solstice, when it's the most extreme kind of angle of the sun to the earth, and we'll talk about that briefly later, and the equinox in the spring and the fall, when it's pretty much even in terms of the sun's direct focus on the earth. The moon, the planets, and the stars, they observed all these things to better predict agricultural seasons, things like the Nile River overflowing time and things like that, and if possible, extraordinary events like comets, guest stars, or eclipses. By guest stars, we mean something we would call a supernova, when a star appears that wasn't in the sky before. And they'd love to be able to predict these, because if they're not predicted, then they're scary, right? And they're ominous. There was at least eclipses recorded in China from about 2137 BC, and there's a comedy story about two astronomers who were executed for failing to predict an eclipse back in that period of time. Oh, we know from the scripture that this is not uncommon in the East, as in Daniel's experience in Babylon, we saw the king was not too tolerant of his interpreters and astrologers and so forth that could not come up with an accurate interpretation of his dream. They weren't used to doing actually real revelation. They were used to doing something less than that. However, eclipse prediction does not require supernatural revelation, as we'll see. People also attributed to heavenly bodies divinity or power to control, or at least reveal, is that blank, at least reveal important aspects of present or future life on earth. And that's a field of activity that we've come to call astrology. Not like modern newspaper astrology. This was more serious. These were guys that worked for the rulers and the kings, and their aim was forecasting the fortunes of the nation, not just somebody's, you know, love life or what you should do, whether you should take a trip today or not, or something like that. Okay, there were several different ones. This is one common, well-known thing that people believe was set up as ability to track solstices and various other things. In fact, they've theorized all kinds of ways you can use the stones here. If you stand here, you can see this, and you stand there. But, you know, probably at least this kind of basic thing. This was a really cool animated GIF that had the sun jumping from thing to thing, but it doesn't work in our presentation thing. But anyway, this is up in the Andes, and these is the mountains were found. This is from fairly bit BC. A lot of the stuff in the Americas was somewhat later, even though it's similar approach to tracking the sun. And it will move to those different things and be at there at the solstice and at the other solstice. It'll be at the other end. And it's a calendar. It's like a large year-long clock that they're able to use. This one you might have to look at more in the if you get the PowerPoint later. But this is the sealing of a tomb in Egypt. And the Egyptians made a lot of significant and detailed astronomical observations, but they tended to write them on paper because they had paper, you know, papyrus, and that was where they wrote. But occasionally something would get into a tomb and sealed up, and then they unseal it, and it looks like this. A very dramatic, preserved record, and they have circles on them representing the months of the year, harvest and so forth, and a bunch of little animals and things in boats and stuff that represent the planets. The planets are in boats because the planets are wanderers. They're not like the fixed stars. They move contrary to the stars. Stars are fixed. So he's got both the constellations, the fixed stars. And this is a Babylonian clay tablet. The advantage, the Babylonians also did a lot of significant observing over centuries, but the advantage that was available for later astronomers was that they wrote on these clay tablets, which did not fall apart. And this is, you know, this is from 17th century BC. I think it's probably in the British Museum. Most things are in the British Museum. It has this is a Venus tablet. It's the risings and settings of the planet Venus. It's one of the things that they focused on. Okay. Well, there's many things from other cultures as well. The Babylonians, going back to the outline, kept well-preserved and detailed records of star names and positions, grouping stars into constellations. I thought I had the constellations. I have an old copy, I think, of that presentation. I must have gotten the wrong one. But anyway, we're familiar with constellations. When we send this out, it'll have all the videos and things in it that didn't work this morning. But basically, a grouping of stars, they look and say, this looks like a hunter, this looks like a dog, this looks like a bear. You know, and if you look at them now and see them, you're going to say, well, that doesn't look like a bear or hunter or anything like that. But they could see very clearly in ancient times, and they had great imagination, and this allowed them to keep track of things. You know, you're familiar with the zodiac or the set of constellations that the sun passes through in the year that the Earth orbits the sun. It passes through, in effect, from our point of view on the Earth, these 12 different constellations. Does it mean anything? Because it, in terms of destiny or you know, so forth, but definitely it's a way of keeping track that's very accurate. Okay, well, they group stars into constellations. The Chinese had hundreds of constellations because they would make them out of only two or three stars. They had in the 40s, well, by the time we get to Ptolemy, had 48. Now they have officially 88 constellations. 88, believe it or not. Okay, and they kept track of rising and positions of planets, different stars. They use this for different seasons. In some cultures, the Pleiades, are you familiar with the Pleiades? I should have a picture, but it's a group of a bunch of stars that you see kind of as a very distinctive little group of stars you can see without a telescope or binoculars or anything. And some cultures would use that as the sign for the rainy season is beginning or the dry season because of when it rises and sets, when you can start to see it at night and when you can't, and so forth. A lot of these kind of things. Basically, exactly what God said he created this for in Genesis 1. Well, the Babylonians, in recording this, mostly did it for the sake of astrology. They mostly did it because they wanted to rely on the stars to be able to forecast things, and they wanted to forecast these events like eclipses and so forth. They used a sexagesimal system, base 60. Have you heard? Well, we still use the base 60 system. Can you think of where? Yeah, like how many seconds is in a minute? How many minutes is in an hour? You know, how, and also importantly, how many degrees are in a circle? Is 360 degrees in a circle. That's another base 60 base computation. Well, this started with the Babylonians, and we've continued using it. They wrote their observational diaries on clay tablets as early as the 8th century BC. That one was even earlier that we had. Maybe it was 7th instead of 17th. I read it wrong. Many years of past data enabled them to make predictions of lunar and solar eclipses simply because they saw these as repeated events, and they could predict them as continuing to occur as they had in the past. They didn't really try to figure out why they were occurring or how it was functioning, but they just wanted to be able to predict the events. Later, they'll call this basically saving the phenomena. They have to come up with an explanation that matches what they're actually seeing. Well, when we get to the Greeks, we shift gears a little bit. This guy Thales, circa 640 to 562, these are all BC numbers, is credited for predicting the year. He's credited by Herodotus, that's the passage there from him, of an eclipse which stopped a war. As he says, the war between the Medes and the Lydians, when they saw this total eclipse occur. Now, the only thing Herodotus had said is about Thales is that he had predicted the year that the eclipse would occur, not where it would be seen, not that it would be a total eclipse, but it was a total eclipse, and it was seen in Asia Minor where this war was going on. And to the Greeks, I guess the traditional thing is that an eclipse means the gods are mad at you. And so they felt like maybe we should stop this war, and they did. So that eclipse stopped a war. This next guy, Pythagoras, and it's not just necessarily him, but the Pythagorean school. The information about him personally is kind of sketchy. But he lived circa 570 to 495 BC. He saw the earth, or they saw the earth, as spherical. You could put round, but spherical is more accurate. And the universe as defined by numbers. Ratios, the golden mean, if you've ever heard of that. They use this in architecture and art. That's something that was a Pythagorean thing. Of course, he's also famous for the Pythagorean theorem, whether he actually developed that or not, that the squares of the sides of a triangle equal the squares of the hypotenuse side. They posited a kind of cosmology where they believed that the sun, they believed the earth rotated around kind of a central fire. It wasn't exactly around the sun. It's kind of complicated. But they were pretty mystical about their astronomy. And to some degree, they did a lot of significant things in math and geometry, but they were mystical even about that, believing that it sort of had a key to understanding the world and reality. And they also related math to music. There's that woodcut up there of the music with Pythagoras there. There's a type of tuning that has perfect intervals between notes, but it's not the same as our tuning that we use now that they call Pythagorean. I tried to listen to a few passages, but it got a little tedious, and I'm glad I didn't bring any in because I wouldn't have been able to play them anyway, as it turns out. Have you heard the phrase, the music of the spheres? It's used in This Is My Father's World, that hymn. Well, this is something that Pythagoras talked about. He believed that the actual planets and the orbits and the stars were actually making music continuously. And you simply didn't hear it because you always heard it. And so it just you tune it out, you know, because it's in the background. Let me not lose my outline too much. After Socrates and Plato had emphasized more, and the word there is rational and rigorous methods of thought than the pre-Socratic guys like Thales and the Pythagoreans. They emphasized logic and reason and so forth. Aristotle, 384 to 322, sought to apply these more rigorous methods to the study of nature. He was mostly interested in biology, but he also studied cosmology and astronomy, or at least philosophized about it. The earth was obviously stationary. I mean, because think about it. You jump up in the air, the earth doesn't move out from under you. You're not feeling it move. Like when you get on a boat, you feel that move. So it was just, obvious that the earth is not moving. It's evidently spherical. Now, I couldn't find anyone in history that believed the earth was flat. So I think that that's a little bit of a goofy thing that they once believed the earth was flat. There's a guy now, apparently, that is teaching it. My son was telling me about and trying to get a following. Australia's not real and so forth. It's a bunch of actors. Okay. But they recognized the earth was spherical, and they did because things like when they went further north, they could see more stars in the north than they could see You know, they could, the North Polar Star was higher in the sky and they could see more stars there. If they went south, they could see more stars in the south and less in the north. Well, the only way that works is if the Earth is spherical. And they were not, you know, they were smart enough to figure that out. Also, on a lunar eclipse, the Earth produced a shadow on the moon that was round. It wouldn't work. Sometimes the Earth would be tilted this way and it'd be like a line in the shadow. Anyway, there's so many things that just no one ever believed that the Earth was flat. So don't, you know, even though maybe they said that was true in your grade school classes. Okay, well, Aristotle also believed the Earth was stationary, and it was the center of the solar system, and it was surrounded by some 55 interacting spheres, crystalline spheres, which moved the sun, moon, planets, and stars. The stars had to move pretty fast because they spun around every 24 hours, right? Unlike the Earth and its moon, what he called the superlunary, that is further out from Earth than the moon, bodies were made of a fifth element. Oh, did I talk about the elements?
No.
Did I miss the elements?
It was right before Socrates.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, Empedocles. Okay, sorry about that. This is really important. You've got to have the elements. Or you don't know what everything's made of. Empedocles, so this is back in the third line of the paragraph, taught that the Earth was made of four basic elements, earth, water, air, and fire. Earth, water, air, and fire, in that order. Earth was the lowest, water, air, and then fire. And if you can see these diagrams like that, this is what they have in the middle of the diagram, earth and water, then air and fire surrounding it. Aristotle believed that earthy things, like if you dropped a rock and it fell to the earth, fell because they were attracted to earth, to the same element. Things wanted to unite with the same element that they are. If you lit a fire, it goes up. What do you know? It's because fire is up, you know, so it wants to unite with the other fire. This sounds kooky to us, but this was serious philosophy that was, largely accepted for quite some time. Well, anyway, unlike the Earth and its moon, the superlunary bodies were made of a fifth element, which he called quintessence, or it's called quintessence in Latin at least, and were perfect, that blank is, and did not change. So if they did not change, he believed that comets and what we called guest stars before and things like that were actually atmospheric phenomena. They were, gas would escape and set on fire and that would be a comet and so forth. Okay. Aristotle saw the universe as living and purposeful. He talked about the causes, and one of the causes he emphasized was the final cause, which meant the purpose for which something exists, and that's how he looked at everything, including the earth. And he was a very influential, way past his time. In fact, this drawing, which is an Aristotelian cosmology, was done in 1539 A.D., we got now. There's the shadow of the Earth on the moon as, you know, a multiple exposure of the moon in a lunar eclipse. You can see that there's a round shadow there. Okay, this is Aristarchus. And so we're right here. Aristarchus of Samos estimated the distance to the sun and relative size of the Earth, moon, and sun. And this is how he did it. He looked at the moon when it was at the first quarter and last quarter, sought to measure the angle, not those 90-degree angles, but the, he's assuming a 90-degree angle because if the moon's at exactly quarter moon, then it should be, you know, that you're looking at it exactly 90 degrees from the way the sun's shining on it. So that's one angle. And then he measured the angle down between the Earth and the moon, in both cases, and then you divide by two and you figure out that last angle. He computed that last angle to be about 87 degrees. It's actually, well, I don't have that on here either. Oh, it's the bottom there. He computed 87 degrees. It's actually 89.85 degrees. So so it's real close to 90. If it was 90 degrees, of course, it wouldn't be a triangle at all. The lines would be parallel, right? So it's very, very far away. So he estimated it to be about 19 times further than the moon. It's actually 390 times further. He estimated the Earth to be 2 to 3 times the size of the moon. It's actually 3.7 times. So he estimated the sun to be 7 times bigger than the Earth. It's actually 109 times bigger than the Earth in terms of size. But he had the right idea, though, especially that it was far away. It was a lot further away. Also, Aristarchus actually saw the sun as the dominant member of the solar system. He had a sort of idea of a heliocentric solar system, but not really worked out in detail. He simply believed the sun is really big, it's far away, it can't be just orbiting around the Earth. It just didn't seem logical to him. And this is long before the guy we'll get to later. Now I got to move along, don't I? Okay, let's move along. Apollonius of Perga studied conic sections and suggested deference in epicycles. Okay, I have to explain what that is, to explain planetary motion. Okay, conic sections are, if you take a cone and you make a plane cut through it, you get these different shapes, a circle, an ellipse, a parabola, and a hyperbola. These are all extremely interesting in terms of things like orbits of planets, turns out. And it takes a while for them to figure it out. In Aristotle's mind, the perfect shape is a circle. These orbits all have to be circled because it's a perfect heavens. But that didn't match what they saw when they watched the planets moving through the sky. Sometimes they move faster and sometimes slower. Sometimes they did this crazy movement, which I had a video of, which was really cool, but that's okay. This little drawing shows epicycles and deferent. That basically means they were suggesting, well, the Earth isn't quite in the center of the orbit of the planets that go around the Earth. It's a little bit offset, and there's another point that's offset on the other direction, and from that point, the speed, if you could get there, you'd see the speed from there is equal. And from the middle, there's a circle, but the speed's slightly different. So they're trying to preserve circles and explain what they're actually observing and save the phenomena. Okay, I had a video of this, but they graciously put in a picture in place of it, which is good, because this shows nightly tracking of the planet Mars through the stars, which don't move, so you can take the same view of the sky every night. The stars are going to be there. I mean, they'll eventually move as you go through the year, you know, but nevertheless, Mars does this kind of a track through the sky. It moves in one direction, it starts coming back the other way, and then it keeps moving in the same direction again. So it's what's called a retrograde motion. And they proposed this epicycle that is around the orbit, it orbits around like this, as a way to explain that retrograde motion. Okay, we'll get back to that when we talk about Ptolemy. Okay, this is Eratosthenes. Yeah. He was the director of the library at Alexandria. He accurately measured the circumference of the Earth. How the distance around the Earth. He accurately measured that. How? He took a gnomon, a stick, basically, in a place called Syene, where the sun was directly overhead. It didn't cast a shadow. And he took one in Alexandria that was a known distance from Syene, and it cast a certain angle shadow. And he used geometry to figure out the angle. He calculated it at a certain amount of degrees, and when he multiplied that times the 360 degrees, he ended up with a measure that was 250,000 stadia. Stadia was perhaps different kinds of measures, but by one measure of the stadia, he would be accurate within 1 or 2%. By another measure, maybe as far off as 10 or 15%. Both of those are pretty good using a method like this. And he was, when was he? He was still more than 200 BC. Here's a guy named Hipparchus, and he created some equipment, like that's what's called a what is it called? No, I'm blanking on the name of that thing, the sphere that he has. Anyway, it's like an armillary sphere or something like that. But it basically tracks the axis of the earth and the heavens and so forth. And he used that to accurately catalog some 850 stars. And he did things like figured the distance to the moon, determined the length of the year within 6 minutes. This thing on the right is something that was called Hipparchos, sort of in his honor, that cataloged more than 200,000 stars, or 100,000 stars, 118,000, with extreme accuracy. But that was a satellite, so you can't really compare that with a guy 200 BC or 150 BC. Okay, what did he mean by precession? He used old, and that's that gyroscope's supposed to be spinning around. But you know how gyroscopes spin around anyway, or a top will spin around, and it actually starts to precess, to go like around the center as it's starting to fall over. Well, he discovered that the Earth was actually doing this. And he discovered it by comparing observations from 150 years earlier. And he computed, I don't know if he computed the accurate time frame, but they believe the time frame now to be about 26,000 years. The Polaris will not be the North Star for that long. So, you know, we can use it for now, but in another 8,000 years, you can't use it anymore. Have you guys heard of this thing called the Antikythera mechanism, which is made BC? They found it in the Mediterranean. It looked like this. They've done all kinds of x-rays of it and everything. They date it to BC. Could be, you know, between 150 and 50 BC or something like that. It was made to track movements of the moon and sun and planets and potentially predict eclipses. Even took into account what's called the aspidal precession of the moon's orbit. That means as the moon orbits the Earth, over something like an 8.8 year time frame, the orbit moves like this of the moon around the Earth. It actually moves. The orbit itself moves. That mechanism, they calculated that in computing the location of the moon. Kind of amazing. Okay, so this guy is named Claudius Ptolemy. He lived circa 100-170 AD now. He produced this massive 13-section astronomical great treatise that was, when it was translated into Arabic, it was called Al-Majist, which was the great thing. And so that's what we call it by now, the Almagest, from the Arabic. And he used Aristotelian logic in terms of his cosmology, Aristotelian model, but with all these deference and epicycles and so forth added. And I had this, it was a video, it was really great. It was just spinning all around with all these curly cues and everything, and shows kind of how his system would have had to actually work. It doesn't make any sense at all. But however, it saved the phenomena. It matched, his system matched. You could predict the positions of planets, and you could predict things with his system. And so since it worked, that's what mattered. It worked. It matched. It saved the phenomena. Well, his system prevailed until the 16th century as the accepted cosmology, not just in the church, but in secular astronomy as well, so to speak. Till this guy came along. Oh, I'm skipping blanks on you here, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
Okay. You could guess. But you don't have to guess. Ptolemy's system, that blank near the end of the paragraph there, enabled better predictions of planetary positions, which was useful for astrology. And again, the more serious type of astrology, where you're trying to predict the fate of the nation, not somebody who paid you for a reading or something. Aristotle's work has been translated into Latin and brought into Europe in the 11th and 12th century and have become entrenched in both, this is important, in both religious scholasticism and secular scholarship. the Roman Catholic Church in 1215 used Aristotle's idea of substance and accidents to come up with the idea of transubstantiation, that you could actually change the substance of something while its accidents, its appearance, remain the same. So that's owing to Aristotle. Without him, they never would have thought of such a thing. So he was heavily used in both the church and outside of the church. Until this guy came along. Well, there were others, but these are the significant ones. Nicholas Copernicus, 1473, and he died in 1543. Born in Torun, Poland, and attended the University of Krakow. And then in Italy, he studied canon law. That's Catholic Church law. And medicine. Picking up in Italy humanistic and Platonic ideas, and he picked up an avid interest in astronomy. He had been granted the office as church canon in Frauenburg, where he served from 1512. Students, including Copernicus, had come to regard church canon was an administrative priest position, church administrator. Students, including Copernicus, had come to regard the complex system of Ptolemy as an inelegant monstrosity. Monstrosity. And you could see on that if you could see it spinning, check it out when they send it out later. It's quite amazing. He wrote a short commentary in 1514 that outlined a basic heliocentric theory, including predicting a great distance to the immovable stars. See, they never could see a parallax with the stars. You guys know what parallax is? If one thing's far away and another thing's close and you move, this thing moves relative to that thing, right? You can see it. They don't look the same. That's what's called parallax. Well, they would look at the stars in, the middle of summer and look at them in the middle of winter 6 months later when the Earth's on the total... And theoretically on the total opposite side of its orbit around the sun and not see any parallax in the stars. It's like, well, how could that be? The Earth must be stationary and the stars must be moving, because if the Earth revolved around the sun, there'd be enough distance where you'd see a very significant parallax. What they didn't realize is what the distance to the stars really was. A lot more than they thought. Okay. Copernicus' magisterial work, De Revolutionibus, and the whole title's there. It's the revolution on the revolutions of the heavenly orbs. A product of mostly analyzing other people's observations, and that was not published until 1543. It was delayed for various reasons, and eventually published in 1543. Copernicus had suffered a stroke, and he died the day a copy reached him. Osiander, the guy who eventually published it after it was handed off from people that got other sidetracked, he anonymously added a disclaimer to the prefix. Do I have that? Yeah. He basically added this disclaimer that's basically said, you don't have to really believe this. You can see the last line that I italicized on there. Astronomer will accept above all others the one which is easiest to grasp. The philosopher will perhaps rather seek the semblance of the truth, but neither of them will understand or state anything certain unless it has been divinely revealed to them. So it's basically an entire disclaimer of which was not authorized, not signed. He did not sign it. It was anonymous. He was a Lutheran minister. By the way, Luther and Calvin did not like Copernicus. But I don't think they really were bothered as much as the Catholic Church would eventually be bothered, but slightly for different reasons. It's not really religion versus science. But the Reformers were not, they didn't like the new system, something they considered an innovation. They were trying to focus on getting back to the old system that had been abandoned, they felt, by Rome. Didn't have time for this new science and stuff. But Osiander wasn't even a great Lutheran, because his views contradicted Luther in a lot of ways. I got to move on. Okay. Tycho Brahe, we'll call him Tycho Brahe, was the last great pre-telescope astronomer and the most accurate. He was a Danish nobleman. Now, these were some distances that Copernicus did for the planets. Let's go to Tycho here. There he is. He was a Danish nobleman who'd been given considerable funding and an island on which he built his house and observatory. He used precision instruments to measure positions. There's this drawing of his house. His house isn't there because when he left, he was not well liked by the local residents. They tore his house down almost immediately after he left. He had to leave because the regime changed. A new king showed up and so on. These are some of the kind of instruments that he built. Very detailed protractors, and they called them quadrants and sextants and the armillary sphere and so forth. He used his instruments to measure positions, proving that a new star, another supernova, and two bright comets were further away than the moon. So they were not atmospheric phenomena. Of course, this, again, something that Aristotle had suggested. And that the comets' orbits would have had to cross over the spheres. But he rejected Copernicus' moving Earth and came up with his own system, another thing that I had moving. But Tycho basically said all the planets revolve around the sun, but the sun, along with all of its planets, revolves around the Earth. So if you see this spinning, which it will, and the one you can download later, you realize this could not possibly work. Nevertheless, it was considered a compromise system. The Earth is still stationary, but all the other planets, in fact, orbit around the sun. He was not a theoretician. He was a technician, and he measured accurately so many things that were used later. Especially by this guy, Johannes Kepler, in 1571 to 1630. He was a German mathematician and astronomer, studied planetary motion and distances. He had a mystical mindset. He wrote something called Mysterium Cosmographicum. You've probably seen, see that picture on the left? You might have seen that drawing before. He drew these five perfect solids as ways to gauge how far the planet's orbits were out from the sun. Just goofy. but it was romantic to him. The five perfect solids were these solids that could be made with the same side shape. You know, there's only five, it turns out. And he gave credit to God and so forth for making things so awesomely mechanically perfect. But he was a smart guy, and apart from this misguided attempt to use those five perfect solids, he got the interest of Tycho and Galileo when he sent them his writings. And later he actually worked for Tycho when Tycho moved to Czechoslovakia temporarily when he had to evacuate his island. And he was able to use Tycho's detailed observations of Mars, which Tycho only grudgingly would let him see. This tended to be a pattern for scientists even down to the present, I think. That's mine. But Kepler knew the orbits were wrong in every system. It just didn't work. And eventually he came up with a simple idea to use ellipses for orbits instead of circles. Now, the thing is, a circle with an offset, an ellipse is basically a shape that's drawn by all the points that are equal distance from two different points that they call the focuses. And I had some of this drawn up like that was supposed to orbit around and stuff, but looks like a circle now. But in any case, he said if you use ellipses for the orbits, they just work. It just, the positions all add up. And so he wrote this up in his new astronomy, Astronomia Nova, 1609, and he detailed these first two laws of planetary motion. Each planet moves in elliptical orbit with the sun as one of the focuses and the other one is just empty. And the second law is interesting, which says the orbit will take the same amount of time to cover and the same amount of area. And you can see that drawing I have on there. Again, I had one of these that was animated. It was a lot easier to see. But this one here, this orbit here, you can see that big, looks like a big area there and a small one there, but the areas are the same. Since the areas are the same, the time it takes to traverse that part of the orbit will be the same, which means it has to move a lot faster. This is very exaggerated in terms of a planetary orbit. Not so much for comets, though. Comets have very exaggerated orbits, like Halley's Comet, which maybe you'll hear about next time. But this is going to travel a lot faster to travel this amount of space than this amount of space. So the elliptical orbits explained the difference in speed that was observed in the planetary orbits. It really was a real difference in speed. Not exaggerated like this would be, but nevertheless, enough that they were seeing it in their measurements. And he revisited the, at least Kepler revisited, he wrote this as what he expected the planet music was. He still liked that Pythagorean idea of the music of the stars. Okay, we're going to move on. So he revisited the music of the spheres, right? Galileo Galilei constructed the first astronomical or astronomy class telescope in 1609. He did not invent the telescope, but he improved it enough where it could be used for astronomy. He published some key subsequent findings in his Starry Messenger. And here's some of the findings. The moon has mountains and valleys. It's not a perfect sphere. Venus shows complete phases. Well, what difference does that make? Well, because if you believed in the epicycles and the Earth-centered solar system, Venus would not show complete phases because the epicycle would all be in front of the Earth. All you'd ever see would be partial phases. And what you really see are not only these phases like this of all different phases of Venus, but it changes size dramatically when it's full. It's actually because it's on the other side of the sun from us. It's far away. When it's in a crescent like this, like the moon would be a crescent, and Galileo did this drawing right here, Galileo's drawing, where he saw these phases as he observed this, and it didn't make any sense. So he's basically absolutely confirming the Copernicus system. Okay, Jupiter has four moons. He saw four moons, so there's another thing with things orbiting it besides the Earth. Saturn has handles. He couldn't see the rings accurately, but he said it had handles. The Milky Way is stars. It was called the Milky Way. Remember, Pete mentioned last week the word for milk was what was used for galaxy. It's the word galaxa, which is Greek for milk. So they didn't know if it was clouds, what it was. But when he got the telescope, he said, this is just a bunch of stars. The sun has spots that show rotation. This is one of his drawings. I had these in an animated sequence too, and you can actually see they sort of look like they're rotating, like the sun itself is rotating. Galileo believed, so let's see, do I got the blanks? Yeah, Milky Way, okay, too. Galileo believed Copernicus' system was true, not just functional. Thus, this, plus his bellicose manner, got him in trouble twice with the church. First, in 1613, he was told not to teach Copernicanism as literally true because it seemed to contradict biblical language. You know, this Joshua told the sun to stand still, and David talks about the sun rising and so forth, and not the earth spinning. It's obviously not meant to be technical language, but they didn't think in those terms necessarily. And then the other problem was that church was already reactionary about changes because they were just finished going through the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. There were a lot of others that were proposing, you know, heliocentric things that didn't get a lot of flack for it. But Galileo also was kind of belligerent in how he did it. And that especially when it came along to the second phase, when he published Dialogue on the Two Chief World Systems, he got permission from the church, from his friend, the Pope, Urban VII, that he would treat both sides evenly. But instead of doing that, he puts the Pope's words, literally, in the mouth of the one character, the fool, Simplicio. He's the character that was defending the geocentric system. He literally has him say some of the things that the Pope had said to him. Okay, well, that didn't work too well. So that book was banned, and he was called up in front of the Inquisition and was convicted of suspicion of heresy. That was the charge that they charged him with. He publicly renounced his errors, although at least the lore is that he, as he's walking out, he said, but it still moves. And he's put under permanent house arrest. Nevertheless, he continued very important work with respect to the dynamics of, some people think, more important work than even his observational astronomy. He continued very important work with respect to dynamics of falling objects, terminal velocity, and parabolic, again, one of those conic sections. He determined that when you throw a projectile or fire it from a cannon, it always has a parabolic trajectory. And he figured out that objects that had a different mass would fall at the same rate. He didn't probably actually drop them from the Tower of Pisa like that. That's sort of a, you know, like, wouldn't that be cool? Mostly he did things like rolling balls down inclined planes to measure this, but he definitely proved that it did not matter that you had a heavier object and a lighter object. Eventually, this astronaut, David Scott, I think Apollo 15, took a feather and a hammer and dropped them on the moon to demonstrate that Galileo's experiment would work when there's no atmosphere on the moon. So quite amazing. And that was in his dialogue concerning the two new sciences. He both believed that the world could be described mathematically and proposed theories needed to be tested experimentally. So he combined what we would consider now, maybe Galileo could be looked at as one of the first of the modern scientists, at least his time frame, because you have a theory, you have a mathematical equation, or you have whatever, but you have to also observe and see if this actually is right, see if it actually matches reality. Well, Pope John Paul II, that's this one here, this article, formally declared Galileo had been right after all, October 31st in 1992. His book had been unbanned in 1757. I forgot I had this little insert on the first page too, that just because it reminded me of it, that it was so long of a time. You can see that about the Julian calendar in the time of Julius Caesar, how the leap year was added. And then the unleap year was added by Pope Gregory in 1582. Every odd century, you don't do a leap year or and so on. But that change was only adopted in England and the U.S. in 1752. Like that's 170 years later. And not in Russia till after the Communist Revolution in 1918. So, and certainly some parts of the Orthodox Church still use the old Julian calendar. Okay, one last guy, the most important guy of all here. Isaac Newton, one of the top three physicists of all time, you'll have to wait till next week to hear about the other two, set forth unifying theories across multiple disciplines, optics, mathematics, cosmology, not cosmetology, but cosmology, and astronomy and general physics. He was born prematurely. His mother said he could fit in a quart jug. Christmas Day, Julian Christmas Day. They remember they were still using the Julian calendar. Woolsthorpe, England, his father having died 3 months earlier. When Isaac was 3 years old, his mother remarried and sent him to live with his grandmother, with her mother. When she was widowed again, she briefly took him home to unsuccessfully try to run the family farm at age 17. He did not have a great childhood. In 1661, he entered Trinity College, Cambridge. He worked for tuition until he got a four-year scholarship in 1664. He received his bachelor's degree in 1665. Then the school closed due to plague, and he went back home. Over the next 2 years at home, he worked out breakthroughs in calculus, optics, motion, and gravitation. Newton invented calculus a bit ahead of the German mathematician Gottfried Leibniz. I think I spelled Leibniz wrong. There should be an I in there. But unpublished, Newton didn't publish, and they argued over who was first. Newton always was concerned about someone taking credit for something he had done. He experimented with prisms and proved that white light was not colored by impurities in the glass, which is what was thought at the time when it was refracted into colors, but actually broken down into real component colors that refracted at different angles. One of the experiments he did, there's kind of an explanatory graphic there, is he actually took separated light and recombined it back to white light using a prism. He would do the experiment that he drew. That's one of his drawings up there on the top, where he put little slots in there so only one color could get through, and he experimented with refracting the single color. He basically demonstrated light was made of these different colors. It consisted of different, I'd say wavelengths, except Newton was not a believer that light was a wave. Others did, but they felt light had to be a wave, had to travel in a medium, and he didn't believe that space had anything in it. There was no ether or whatever that it could travel in. So he believed in a particle theory of light. It turns out light is both a wave and a particle, but you'd have to wait till next week. I think you might hear. I don't know if you'll hear about that or not, but it behaves in both different ways. Since that chromatic aberration, that is the fact that different colored light refracts different amounts, would affect lenses. You can see on the bottom, a lens has got sections of a lens are kind of like a prism. And it refracts light at different amounts. Therefore, when it focuses, you see these fringes of different color sometimes through a lens, at least when you're trying to focus very precisely. He designed, so this would affect lenses, so Newton designed a reflecting telescope that used a polished mirror. That's a model of his replica of what he had built with a little round base. And there's a diagram of how it works. The light reflects off a mirror, bounces off another mirror, and it hasn't gone through a lens. This is what all major large telescopes are now, reflecting telescopes. Refractors are also super expensive to build accurate lenses, but this is what's used now for as much as 10-meter, I think, 30-foot mirrors and single mirrors. And then there's some larger ones that are composite. In April 1667, he went back to Cambridge, received his master's degree. Then in 1669, at the age of 26, became professor of mathematics. The Royal Society, which was a recent creation, Royal Society for Science, had elected him a fellow, and he submitted a paper on optics in 1672. It was well received, but also criticized by Robert Hooke, another scientist in particular, which provoked Newton's angry outburst and lifelong resentment of Hooke. He did not publish his optics until 1704, after Hooke had died. He did write to Hooke in 1676, a famous saying, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." And it was at a time of they had somewhat better relations. Although some people have said this is a dig at Hooke for being short or something like that also. But he noted Hooke's and others' work at one point in the Principia, although very briefly. In 1684, Edmund Halley, famous for the comet that he predicted, came to Newton with an orbital problem he, Hooke, and others could not solve. Newton immediately gave him the solution, basically that the least squares... Yeah, okay, that's too much to go into right now. Basically that if gravity falls off like light does with the square of the distance, if you're twice as far away, it's only a quarter as strong. If that's true, what kind of orbits would the planets have? And he said, ellipse. He already figured that out, you know. Basically, mathematically confirming what Kepler had seen observationally, you know. And Newton reconfirmed that with equations. He wrote up that answer, and Halley was very impressed and a super fan of Newton. At Halley's insistence, plus Halley's partial financial backing, Newton produced his greatest work, Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, which they call the Principia, in 1687. He outlines the three laws of motion that you've got to be familiar with. Inertia, an object in motion will stay in motion unless it's acted on by an external force. Now, Aristotle said, nothing's in motion. Everything wants to stay at rest unless it's some violent force makes it move. But in reality, the opposite is true. Things are always moving unless some force stops them from moving. The planets orbit, suppose you roll a ball on the ground, it won't keep moving, right? Because there's a force called friction that's working against it to alter it. But in the absence of friction, in the absence of gravity, in the absence of other forces, things keep moving. That's their natural state, is moving. So that's a significant proposal, and one that's actually true with limitations that you'll have to wait 200 years later to find out about. The force to accelerate an object is proportional to its mass. That means if you want to move something and it's heavy, you have to push more force than you do if it's not heavy. You'll get the amount of acceleration. So acceleration is the issue, not motion. Things are always in motion, but to change that motion, even to stop it, requires force. Okay, so that's an acceleration, a negative or positive acceleration. And objects exert equal and opposite forces on each other, which is what you've heard probably said, like, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It basically says if two things collide, they both exert forces on each other simultaneously and equal. The force is always equal. The effect isn't always equal because the mass of one thing might be big and the other thing might be small. In book three, he laid out the simple formula for one last blank, universal gravitational attraction. And there's a little formula there, but basically means that the force of gravity is equal to the product of the masses of two objects divided by the square of their radius. Again, it falls off based on the square of how far away you are. Basically, it means this. If you drop an apple, like the story is, an apple fell, and this is how Newton got this idea. If you drop an apple, the Earth has drawn the apple to it with this force called gravity. Now, they weren't quite sure what gravity was. They're still not quite sure, actually, what gravity is. But they, you know, there had been studies on magnetism. They thought it may be some form of magnetism or something. But he just posited it just, this is how it works, and it always works this way. Not only is the Earth attracted the apple, but the apple has also attracted the Earth at the same time. And the reason it doesn't matter that much for the Earth is because it has a lot more mass than the apple, right? So it's insignificant. But nevertheless, it's very significant for measuring things like the orbits of planets around stars, moons around planets, and making these predictions and so on. On top of his work in science, Newton served as a member of Parliament. That's what MP is. And Master of the Mint, briefly. He loved to bust counterfeiters when he was Master of the Mint. And he wrote some dubious, very dubious Bible commentaries on things like Revelation and Daniel, I think. He did not like the doctrine of the Trinity and felt that Athanasius was a perverter of the faith, a guy I would consider one of the heroes of the faith by inventing the idea of the Trinity. What he actually did is simply stand up for the biblical teaching that Christ was in fact God, as he made very clear in various places in the book of John and other places. Okay, so don't read his Bible commentaries. Forget about that. His science, however, was unbelievably great. Interaction with the work of others was more essential to his discovery than he or others would often acknowledge, but Newton was the one who put it all together. His simple and elegant laws of mechanics and gravity would guide physics and astronomy for the next 200 years, and that only takes us up to the late 18th century, or 19th century rather, and so you'll have to wait for next week to hopefully find out why it only worked for 200 years. There's some paintings of Newton, and some quotes that shows how much Halley thought of Newton. He said, "Nearer the gods no mortal may approach." That's how he described Newton. Alexander Pope wrote this verse that he wanted to be included on Newton's epitaph, but they did not use it. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, "Let Newton be, and all is light." He was a very significant figure, but it is possible to get nearer to God without being a genius, because God has done what's necessary to be near to you. He's the one who's bridged the gap. He has not required you to have a super intelligence to figure out, you know, how the creation he created works in various ways. And believe me, part two of this is way more significant discoveries than part one. And part one, I thought, felt pretty significant and pretty dramatic. They already could see that the stars were, millions and millions of miles away, let's just say. And that the universe was much bigger than they'd even dreamed and thought. And we're much smaller. But nevertheless, God has done the thing that necessary to bridge that gap with each one of us personally. Like David said in that Psalm 8 passage I read, "When I look at the heavens and the work of your hands, why are you concerned about man? And yet he is. Not only was he concerned about man, he became man in order to redeem man. It's hard to fathom the disparity between the greatness and the humbleness. So I'm going to pray. Father, we thank you for the reality that you have not only created an awesome universe, but you've reached down into that universe and you continue to do so into our lives, and you've brought us to a knowledge of yourself. This is the most important thing of all. We thank you for the study and the understanding of creation, because we want to have and do have the same reaction David had. What is man that you're mindful of him? We see what you've created and we worship you, the creator, we worship you, the redeemer, and we worship you, the God and master of all. We thank you for all these things, Lord, in the name of your son, Jesus. Amen.